longtime chair Leroy Barker has moved to Oregon and decided that was, you know, not gonna be that easy to try to chair the committee from there. It's my pleasure to introduce Michael Carey, our speaker today. You probably all know Michael Carey. He's the longtime editorial page editor of the Anchorage Daily News, was the editorial page editor of the Daily News, and has been a columnist for years, and is also the current host of Anchorage Edition. And you have probably seen him get some national airplay recently. So we're really looking forward to this program. It sounds great.
Thank you, ma'am. Thank you very much. Pleasure to be back, see such a big crowd, and see so many people I know. And there's some people here who spent some time in Fairbanks, which is always fun for me. Just a word before we start. I'm going to try and keep it to like 30. And I'm not going to, as I've done in other presentations, when I've referred to the handouts that I have, what we're going to do is I'm going to talk for 30, 35 minutes, and then we'll take like 10 minutes to go through the handouts to sort of illustrate, to explain what they illustrate, why they're significant. And obviously, these are things to take home. People like to have little things to take away from any public event, and this is mine. So with that, I'll get started, and we'll have I'll make a presentation for 30, 35 minutes, and then I'm going to tell you something about the handouts and how they illustrate this particular story. On the morning of October 17, 1953, a Saturday, the people of Fairbanks woke up to discover a murder had been committed during the night. This murder, unlike any in the prior history of Fairbanks, would become national and international news as reporters from all over the United States and Britain wrote about the death of 51-year-old Cecil Wells. Life magazine, for example, did a huge spread on the murder and Wells' much younger fifth wife. The aftershocks of the killing were felt throughout the community, as many Fairbanksans, and the city at that time was about 12,000, including the military bases, were in one way or another affected. First, there were the police officers who rushed to the scene of the crime, the medical staff who examined the body, the neighbors who were interviewed as potential witnesses, prosecutors who drew up indictments after putting names on lists of suspects, members of the public who became coroner's jurors or who served on a grand jury, or were called as witnesses before one of these juries. Above all, there were members of the large Wells family who not only had to face the murder of Cecil Wells, but an estate and custody struggle. And then there was Diane's friend, her paramour, musician Johnny Warren, whom the newspapers almost without fail referred to as, quote, Negro jazz drummer, unquote, Johnny Warren. There was no Perry Mason moment in this case when a defendant stood up and admitted, I did it, I did it. In fact, no one was ever tried for the murder of Cecil Wells. And only one person ever went to jail on any charge associated with this case, a dance instructor, something of a fop and a fool, who outlived every major player in this case and now makes his home in Henderson, Nevada. My dear friend Karen Erickson, without whom I couldn't have done this particular work, who works in the courthouse in Fairbanks, went to see this particular man in Henderson, Nevada, and he just smiled at her and wouldn't talk about the case. When I asked the prosecutor in this particular case, whose name was Theodore Fulton Stevens, to describe William Columbany, he exploded. That idiot! What made this case a sensation, talked about for years in bars and coffee shops in Fairbanks? It had everything the tabloids thrive on. A rich dead husband, a beautiful younger wife, a jazz musician paramour who was black, Afro-American. In other words, this was a case about money, sex, and race, the tabloid editor's trifecta. I'm going to refer just at the start to one of the items, and that is the Northward Building. This photograph on the front, or it's actually a design or architect's sketch of the Northward Building. This is where Cecil Wells died in room 815. The Northward Building was viewed as the great symbol of modernization in Fairbanks. It was our first big, new, modern, stateside building. You could live in there all winter. They had food, they had restaurants, they had a bar. You never had to leave during the wintertime. It was obviously much warmer and much more secure than living in a little cabin, and many Alaskans made it their home if they could afford such a lovely place. One of the people who was living there was the district attorney, Ted Stevens. He was asleep several floors below the Wells apartment when Cecil Wells died. Now, how was Cecil Wells murdered? Let's start with the description that his wife, Diane, gave to the police. Diane said that she and Cecil had gone to the movies on the Friday the 16th and come home somewhere late in the evening, and after perhaps conversing, reading the newspaper, enjoying one another's company in the apartment building, in their apartment, they both went to bed, and that sometime during the night, Diane was awakened by a noise in the room. She thought it was her husband moving around. It wasn't. It was two strangers who she could not identify, who seemed to be tall and wearing watch caps and had their collars pulled up around their necks so that they could be poorly identified. And in the dark, they had assaulted Cecil Wells and eventually killed him and taken whatever money they could find in the house. It turned out to be more than $1,000 in cash and a variety of other valuables. Diane was obviously in some trauma. It was a traumatic experience. She described this to the police in terms that were both very vivid and very emotional as she was interviewed after the murder. She said that she had been knocked out, that she only came to early in the morning, somewhere around 6 or 7 o'clock, and she crawled down the hall of the apartment building in the Northward Building to raise the alarm, and neighbors were alerted and came running to the apartment. The story was greeted quickly by a certain amount of skepticism by the police, who didn't understand how some intruders could get into this very lovely apartment building and get in the door without the help of somebody inside. The police chief at that time was E.V. Danforth, Everett Danforth, and he was a new to Fairbanks. He was from Seward. He'd just been there a few months, and he openly expressed a certain amount of skepticism at her story. But there had been similar crimes in Fairbanks up to this time, two or three of them, in which complete strangers had broken into homes of very middle class and respectable people and robbed them. In fact, somebody died in one of these break-ins. It wasn't totally implausible, although Mr. Danforth, the chief of police, openly expressed some kind of reservations. Now let's take a look at the biographies, or brief biographies, of the three major players who were involved in this case. The first was Cecil Wells. Cecil Wells was an Alaska success story with a few warts. He was born in Litchfield, Pennsylvania in 1902, which is south of the New York-Pennsylvania line, and grew up in several places, but one of them was Spencer, New York, which is south of Ithaca, New York, 16, 18 miles, something like that. I went to school in Ithaca, and so I know that country, and it would have been farming country probably at that time. Cecil received an industrial education after finishing high school in Buffalo, where he learned automobile mechanics and automobile repair and turned to the automobile industry. Like many others, he came to Alaska for economic opportunity. And in Alaska, by 1930, in Anchorage, he was a mechanic and auto dealer. He was in Anchorage before he was in Fairbanks. He was, I am told, I wasn't able to verify this, but it's very plausible, and that he was the first auto dealer to actually sell the cars from a showroom here in Anchorage. Prior to that, the car dealer would have a would have a catalog, and you would look at the catalog just like you were ordering from Sears and Roebuck and say, I want this one. And 3 or 4 months later, the car would show up here in Anchorage, and you would be able to drive it away having paid for it. Cecil was very successful in these as a car dealer. In 1939, he decided, however, to leave Anchorage and move to Fairbanks. I'm told, although this is there's a lot of this that is unclear, that this was associated by one of his divorces, but I don't know if that's true. In Fairbanks, he opened Wells Motors, which eventually became Aurora Motors, very well-known business in Fairbanks, located at First and Lacey, and right now the Rabinowitz Courthouse sits on some of that ground. At one point, Cecil Wells was arrested and tried for bigamy, and this would have been in the 20s when he was married here and was married in the States. The recording of this calls it adultery, which some of you may know from previous presentations I've given, was a crime in territorial Alaska. I haven't been able to find the sentencing document, so I don't know what kind of a sentence he received for this. I've heard it was as much as a year, which I doubt. More likely is a period of months, which I seems more in keeping with with the charge. Cecil was very active in the Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce, very active in the State Chamber of Commerce, becoming the president of the State Chamber of Commerce. He had his own airplane. He flew around Alaska. He flew to the States. He frequently made trips to see auto dealers in the States, get the latest information on cars, also to promote Alaska. He was a very vigorous and successful businessman. Who was Diane, his wife? She was originally Diane Baker. She was born in Oregon in 1922. She was married before she married Cecil in September of 1949 here in Fairbanks. They met in Seattle. In fact, between them, Cecil and Diane had 8 marriages and 6 divorces, which sounds, I hate to be irreverent, but it reminds me a little of a major league pitcher's record, 1-8, lost 6. They had 8 children between them. He had 5 with her first, he had 5 with his various wives. She had 2 with her first husbands, and they had 1 together, their son Mark Wells, who would now be 60 years of age. He was born in 1950. As for Johnny Warren, the musician, paramour, and who was repeatedly noted in the boyfriend in this love triangle, Johnny Warren was born in Columbia, Mississippi in 1919. His mother was a school teacher. He came from educated people. Johnny's service record says he had 3 years of college, so clearly he was educated. He was a musician in the military and trained in music. Johnny was raised to sing gospel music and to play the piano, and he played in New Orleans in various bands at the age of 16 years of age. He also performed all up and down the West Coast. You can find records of him during the 40s before he came to Fairbanks and the 30s, primarily out of Oakland, California, where I was able to find at least one musician born in 1920 who knew him personally and knew the places that he had performed. Whether it's jazz music, pop music, or even orchestral music, not everybody gets to become Duke Ellington. But there were thousands of musicians who were performing all over the United States, earning a living or earning a part-time living. Johnny Warren was one of them. He came to Fairbanks to perform and stayed. He'd been there something like 6 or 7 years by this time. And he worked part-time in a grocery store to supplement his income. To show you a little bit about his sort of, I guess you'd say, status in the music community, he was the local business agent for the Musicians Union. He was a drummer, he was a vocalist, and clearly he was well-known throughout the community. Now, obviously, an investigation began as soon as Mrs. Wells raised the alarm, Diane, and investigators rushed to the apartment to investigate the murder. Fairbanks Police Department, with only 2 or 3 employees besides the chief, had a hard time keeping this dramatic case together. For one thing, the evidence became missing, was lost in the course of the investigation. The fingerprinting was very poor and in some cases was very messy, in other cases lost. And it seems, although this is really hard to believe, even from the reporting at the time, that the police chief was of the opinion that Cecil Wells had been beaten to death and didn't realize he had been shot until a doctor explained this to him through the investigation. All of this provoked the ire of the district attorney in Fairbanks, Ted Stevens. Now, a little bit about Ted Stevens, who many people in this room knew very well, and some in this room practiced in the same courtroom with him. Ted Stevens was born in Indianapolis and raised in Indianapolis and Southern California. He served in World War II. After World War II, he received a degree from UCLA and from the Harvard Law School and began practicing law in Washington, D.C. before he drove the Alaska Highway and arrived in Fairbanks in early 1953. He went to work with the venerable firm of Collins and Clasby, but quickly he had the opportunity to become the federal prosecutor in Fairbanks. Now, why would somebody who just drove the Alaska Highway be considered for federal prosecutor in Fairbanks? The story is essentially this. Dwight Eisenhower had been elected president of the United States in 1952. There were going to be big changes in appointments throughout Alaska. For example, Ernest Greening was about to step down as the appointed governor of Alaska after all the years he had been here under Roosevelt and Truman. There was an opening for a prosecutor in Fairbanks. At that time, there were very few lawyers in Fairbanks who were Republicans. You could count them on one hand, especially since the whole bar probably totaled less than 20 people at that time. So there weren't many candidates. And Ted Stevens was thought of as being young, well-educated, honest, aggressive, and a straight arrow, if not necessarily experienced either in the law or the criminal law. This would have been his first venture into the criminal law. He was appointed in 1953, so that in the summer of 1953. So this murder came only weeks after he had been appointed the federal district attorney for Fairbanks and all of Interior Alaska. And he had yet to be confirmed by the Congress. So in a certain sense, he was on probation when this terrible crime was committed and when the community was all up in arms about who did it, let's get to the bottom of this, why is it taking so long, all the things you can imagine that accompany the kind of headlines that are part of any sensational murder case. There was an inquest, as you would expect. It took quite a lot longer. I mean, they moved very fast in these days. This would have been by the end of October they started the inquest program. A coroner's jury, after meeting a number of days, returned a verdict that Cecil Wells had been killed by persons or persons unknown. A grand jury met in November to follow up on the question of the persons and persons unknown. And you have to realize at this time, there were news, the Daily News Miner at that time and Jessen's Weekly, which was the weekly paper in Fairbanks at that time, were putting out stories virtually every day about this particular, about the murder. The grand jury met in November, and both the jurors and the district attorney were well aware of the anxiety in the community. You can see editorials, not just news stories, but editorials in the News Miner by their publisher, Snedden, talking about how we need to work together. The police has to do a better job. We have to get to the bottom of this. There has to be apprehension of those who committed this heinous crime. A prominent man in Fairbanks killed at home in his bed. How could this happen? What's next? Well, the grand jury indicted Johnny Warren and Diane Wells, and in a side. I find this really interesting and, in fact, surprising. I sort of wonder if it could happen today. Grand juries are entitled to offer opinions on any number of things, And this grand jury offered the opinion that the chief of police, Danforth, E.V. Danforth, ought to be fired because he was incompetent. Now, this did not sit very well with Mr. Danforth because, obviously, he would lose his job, but he pointed out the obvious to the community. The man who was in charge of the grand jury, and presumably in Danforth's view, had led the grand jury to this opinion, was none other than Theodore Stevens, who was his rival in the investigation of this case. The question of jurisdiction here is an interesting one. Ted Stevens argued that the federal system should be responsible for investigating this case. That would be the U.S. Marshal's Office in particular. Because there really was, the federal government was law enforcement in Alaska, and virtually even the local law enforcement would have been a subsidiary to the federal government at that time. Danforth, the police chief, fought back bitterly. After all, Stevens had impaneled the grand jury himself. Nevertheless, Danforth clearly saw that it wasn't any good to continue his fight with Stevens and resigned on November 30th, 1953. So you can see now we're about 6 weeks into the crime. Danforth then went on to be interviewed by many magazines and newspapers, explaining why he would have, if they just left him on the job and allowed him to investigate the crime, it would have been solved much sooner. And the outcome perhaps would have been different. Now, as for the state of the evidence at this point, there were the bloody clothes of Cecil Wells and, to some degree, Diane, who his wife, who was in the same room with him when he died. There were the messy fingerprints. There were broken flower pots. Diane had been, she said, hit on the head by one of the assailants with a flower pot in the house. There was Diane's statement to the police, which Danforth and others had greeted with some kind of skepticism. And there was this. The fact that Johnny Warren was in the building, the Northward building, that morning, he said between 4 and 6 o'clock, he said he was there to, he was driving to back to his family in Oakland, California. He was leaving Alaska, and he was there, who said he wanted a ride and was going to share the expenses. That person never showed up, and Johnny left for California, driving out of Fairbanks at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. And then there was also this. The police were able to establish the caliber of the gun. It was the make of the gun. It was a .38 Beretta, an Italian gun. Warren had owned such a gun and later said that he didn't have it at the time of the crime because he'd sold it to a man in the men's room in Fairbanks. He couldn't remember the name of the fellow. So there were those pieces of additional evidence. When the indictment came out in November, Johnny Warren was in Oakland, California, with family and friends, and Diane Wells was in Seattle recuperating from the emotional trauma of the killing. Both were jailed briefly and allowed bail, and both, or rather, I should say, both were allowed bail, but Diane Wells was able to return to Alaska voluntarily. Johnny Warren was brought back to Fairbanks. I'm going to explain that. Actually, he was extradited, and Frank Wirth picked him up. He was I don't know how many of you knew Frank. I'm not sure now I'm a little bit confused in the way I'm telling the story. I think it must be that Johnny Warren made bail when he got back to Fairbanks rather than California, because he didn't come back on his own. He was brought back by Frank Wirth or Francis X. Wirth, who was a marshal and private detective here in Anchorage, and maybe some of you had dealings with him. He just died here a couple of years ago. He was also a member briefly of the territorial legislature. Trial was set for April, and the defendants obtained lawyers to prepare themselves for their defense. Johnny's lawyer was Everett Hepp, H-E-P-P, who, again, a few people here may have known. Everett Hepp was a very good defense lawyer. He later became a judge for many years. My dad, who had many, many complaints about lawyers, liked Everett Hepp, so I always thought that was probably something in Everett Hepp's favor. Diane went through a number of lawyers, and this is interesting because the first lawyers who came to her defense or came to help really represent her as a victim were Cecil's lawyers, who were mostly property lawyers, helping him deal with his mining claims, the automobile business, various other investments. So they weren't. She didn't have Warren Taylor, one of the other criminal lawyers who were so well known in town. There were only a few, but she did not have a criminal lawyer. And she went through a number of lawyers for a variety of reasons as they tried to find somebody who was a really good defense attorney, and when she was finally charged. Part of the problem with finding a lawyer for her was the Wells family did not want, once she was indicted for murder, Cecil's money to be used to defend her from murdering him. And so there was quite an outcry over this from the family and from others, and quite a lot of correspondence back and forth about who would defend her and how it would be paid for, although ultimately she did have lawyers. She was going to have money for the kind of defense. Now, I want to talk to you a little bit about the publicity. I emphasized that at the beginning. It's really hard to believe, even though I grew up in Fairbanks, how much publicity there was. There was a gigantic spread in Life magazine. It was in the New York Daily News, which you will see in your packet when we go on to explain that a little bit. It was in newspapers up and down the West Coast, as I've demonstrated here from some of the handouts you have, and we'll talk about those again. One of the things that I really wish I had done more of was to see how the black press, the Afro-American press, had handled this. If some of the big papers in the big cities had picked it up. Jet magazine did pick it up, and they had stories about him. And I think you have to know that in virtually every story about Johnny Warren and Diane and their relationship, their trysts, their meetings, how they got together, there was some, it was always, his race was always mentioned, and his occupation was always mentioned. Jazz musician. There was an assumption about those kind of things that is just impossible to miss in the emphasis that was placed on both race and his occupation. You have to remember that this is the 1950s. Those of you who remember your history will know the Emmett Till in Mississippi. This was one of the major events in the history of the civil rights movement, as much as it was a terrible tragedy to Till and his family. The charge was, or the allegation was, that Till was killed because of the way he had looked at a white woman. You will also remember, I can tell you, because this is some research I did, and I gave you may remember a speech I gave here on Jack Bennett, who was tried for for white slavery, bringing women up over the trail, that pretty much amounted to that, the Alcan Highway, from Galveston, Texas. Galveston, Texas, in the 50s, at this time, had open prostitution. It was conducted within full view of the police, who were probably bought off. There was only one crime that was enforced in Galveston, and when it came to prostitution, that was interracial sex. This would not be tolerated by the law. So this is the environment in which, although here, one could argue that it was different, and Ted Stevens did make that argument, as you will see. I wanted to emphasize one other thing. I mentioned earlier the 38 Beretta. It appears that somebody, and this informant is not named, came forward and said, I owned a Beretta here in Fairbanks, and I sold it, and here's the serial number. You can't imagine the fantastic links that the FBI went to find this 38 Beretta. This is something I obtained under the Freedom of Information Act. This is Cecil Wells's, this is his FBI record as obtained under Freedom of Information subject, Cecil Moore Wells. It goes on for pages and pages and pages and pages. It's kind of interesting in the sense that a number, and you're going to see this in the handouts that you have if you haven't seen them already, a number of names, locations, various other details are redacted. And they're taken out. You don't know. You have to infer. Somebody with my experience can put together who's doing the talking and these kind of things. But not always. Not always. And I also tell, it's quite interesting that, and I guess it's sadly inevitable, that in here are included letters that Diane received from various people, including people who are in the hospital who seem to be men, who seem to be mental patients, who had read Life magazine about her and were more or less proposing marriage or some kind of relationship. The FBI searched Fairbanks for this gun. They found out that the gun at one point, this .38 Beretta, had been owned by an individual who lived in Monterey, California. FBI agents in Monterey, California went to see this particular man and asked him, you know, not only do you have ammunition from the gun that you had before, but is there any place that you shot the gun that we can go and look and see if we can find bullets that will match the slugs from the gun that killed Cecil Wells in Fairbanks? There is a description in this FBI report of FBI agents going out to a wooded area not far, maybe it was 20 miles from Monterey, I forget right now, and crawling around in the bushes looking for shells, for a casing, and for slugs that might have been expended as many as 10 years ago. That's how intent they were on the search for an expended shell that might be able to, or excuse me, I keep wanting to say shell, really slug or bullet that would match up with the one that killed Cecil Wells. The trial was scheduled for April the 5th, 1954. But there was no trial. On March 9th, 1954, Diane Wells committed suicide, taking an overdose of barbiturates in the Hollywood Plaza Hotel in Hollywood. She had registered there under an assumed name. This set off another huge round of publicity generated by three words, blonde, suicide, and Hollywood. Diane's remains were sent to Hollywood Forever, which is still a functioning cemetery in Los Angeles. Among others who are buried there are Cecil B. DeMille, Douglas Fairbanks, and John Huston. I mean, this was at one time a celebrity's final resting place. Diane left notes. There were several before she died. And one of them was addressed to Bill Columbani, who was one of her friends, and we're going to talk about him before we finish in some detail. He was a close confidant of hers. Another was, essentially, that was a thank you note to her friend Bill Columbani for standing by her and all she had done. Others were addressed to the world, and I have them in the material if you have. They may not be easy to read there because they're in her hand. But this is Terrence Cole writing in Sneddon's biography. He says, calls her suicide note cryptic. She says, "For one thing, I am guilty of ever seeing Warren. If Warren is guilty, one thing is for sure, Cecil is dead, and I must be the cause of it one way or the other." There is plenty of ambiguity in these notes. It is not a note that says either I did it or I didn't do it. It's a note in which essentially this young woman, and she was young, takes personal responsibility without saying I did it. This left Ted Stevens with the task of trying Johnny Warren by himself. Ted Stevens was unwilling to do that for a variety of reasons. I can tell you, I'm on several occasions, more than several, tried to get together with Ted to talk about these things, and he was always very good about being willing to meet me and talk to me when he had time, which, as everybody knows, wasn't very often. And he asked me on several occasions to meet him in public places. You just can't interview a person like Ted Stevens in a public place. He knows everybody in town, and they all want to say hello. So I did get from he was still of the belief, his original belief, that Wells and Diane Wells and Johnny Warren had done it. But at the same time, it would have been a very difficult trial, because it appears that his hope or his theory was he'd be able to split the defendants and perhaps get them to testify against one another. It should be noted that the Wells estate, the probate file, which is in Juneau, is very large. Cecil Wells, and there's a clip in there that says he was worth more than $400,000. I think eventually it proved to be more than that, and it was divided in a variety of ways. His little son, Mark, who was Diane's son, their child, who was 3 years old at the time and is in many, many of these photographs that are part of the story, a large part of the estate went for his upkeep and well-being in the hands of an aunt that would have been Cecil's sister. And then there was a custody dispute that lasted quite some time over Mark Wells. He eventually put him in the hands of his aunt. Diane's mother, Diane Baker Wells, Diane Baker Walker Wells, wanted to have him as her grandson, but the court ruled in favor of the of the Wells family, and that's where Mark went for to be raised as a very small child. Now, I wanted to talk to you finally about perhaps, I don't know if the strangest character in this story, but certainly somebody who was very unusual in this story. And his name is William Colombani, C-O-L-O-M-B-A-N-Y. Bill Colombani was a close friend of Diane Wells, and is the only person who was actually brought to trial for anything in the course of this many-month investigation. Bill Colombani was born in Guatemala, came to the States as a young man, served in the military at the end of World War II, and became a naturalized American citizen. And he came to Anchorage in the early 50s, where he was opened a dance studio and then tended bar at the Ambassador, where he was well-known. He moved to Fairbanks in the 50s and opened a dance studio in the Northward Building. Diane was among, and her husband Cecil were among, clients. There's a long history of Arthur Murray's dance studios teaching people how to dance, and certainly I'm a person who could have benefited from that if I had any sense. But there also, it seems to be that whenever people have excess cash in this country, there are people who come forward to be dance instructors. And whether Colombani was a Lothario or what exactly he was, it's not clear exactly what his relationship with Diane was, except confidant. There is really nothing in the record that suggests it was a sexual relationship, but we don't know. Colombani he was in the building. He also lived in the Northward Building. He came home probably after the crime was committed. I mean, it was clear that he was in a variety of bars and was not much evidence. So he never was a suspect that he might have committed this crime. Alaska was full of people who were operators in many sense in the early days. Some of you here no doubt knew Chuck Herbert, who was an engineer, a mining engineer, as well as a commissioner of natural resources under Bill Egan. Colombani at one point convinced Chuck Herbert that they could go to South America and find uranium and we're going to get rich. Chuck told me this himself. He went to South America and to Guatemala and parts of Mexico. I said, what happened? He said, Columbania rode a big horse and liked to go around in the jungle as sort of king of the jungle. We never found any uranium. I said, you mean you really went down there and looked? He said, yes. Then he went on to explain to me, and in my notes I had two different interviews with him, and Chuck was getting on, although I guess in I should be fair to him. The question isn't here, was he mixed up? The question was I mixed up? Because he said he had these, what got him going and so interested were these specimens that Columbani had shown him of either uranium or asbestos that were so beautiful and so richly and such rich potential that he thought, man, a lot of money. You know where more of this is, Columbani? Yeah, sure, I know where more of this is. Well, it turned out later he showed these particular samples after Columbani had disappeared from Alaska to a mining engineer from Whitehorse who said, yeah, I know those. I'm really familiar with them. In fact, Columbani stole them from me. Actually, Chuck said, it seemed to me that what Columbani wanted me to do was to pay for his vacation in Guatemala and Mexico. I did. Ted Stevens believed, and I don't know if there was exactly personal animosity in this, but he believed that Columbani, as Diane's friend, had attempted to solicit perjury from a man named Bob Caffey, who I knew, who was married to a friend of mine's aunt. That's kind of how it works in Fairbanks. I was in the same room with Bob Caffey many, many times. In any case, in 1955, Ted Stevens obtained an indictment and tried Bill Columbani on a charge of soliciting perjury. The evidence, this is a good example for all the lawyers in the room of why you shouldn't, there are times when your client shouldn't testify, no matter how often he says, I can tell them, boy, when they hear my side of the story, they're really going to light up because I know the true facts about this. It seems to me, I just read the transcript of the appeal or attempted appeal. It looks like there really wasn't an appeal, but there was a transcript in which essentially it was this. Bob Caffey said he was also a musician like Warren. He knew Warren, and he said that he had been in a bar one night, and Columbani, who was so close to Diane, her friend and neighbor and confidant, came to him and said, would you testify to these various things about Diane and Warren that would throw light, as he put it, on Warren and throw the light off Diane Wells? And at least in his statement here on the witness stand, Caffey said, no, I wouldn't do that. And Warren kept saying, but, you know, the case is so good against Warren and it's not so good against Diane. And Caffey said reasonably, well, if the case is so good, why do you need me to lie about it? Anyway, these are the kind of things that he testified to on the stand. There would have been no other witness, except and Warren Taylor could have rested right there, but he didn't. Columbani decided to go on the witness stand. And historically, I mean, I suppose this would be true even in any moment. If you read the record of a case, you can't really know the effect that a person has, a witness has on the jurors. This must have been a very bad effect because it seemed to me, just on reading, what it would have been Caffey's word against Columbani's if there had been no additional testimony by Columbani. But he testified and he was convicted and was sentenced to two months in prison, 60 days, which he served in the jail in Fairbanks with a whole bunch of other people, probably in the drunk tank. I had originally thought that he would be shipped to McNeil Island or someplace in Seattle or near there or even in California to serve out this sentence, but he was. Served 60 days and pretty much disappeared. Warren Taylor is a really interesting lawyer and an old-fashioned lawyer and a great one for every objection starts with, now just a moment here. And it must be catching, because after a while, Ted Stevens starts saying that. Just a moment here. But there is, Warren Taylor had himself a very sweet moment. He was cross-examining Caffey. And Warren was trying to show that these people were in some degree rivals, and they weren't really friendly, and they'd had a couple of minor fist fights and disagreements. He was trying to establish that there would be a motive for Caffey to tell Ted Stevens and the federal government that Colin Batty had approached him, in other words, to hurt him in some way. So Warren Taylor says to Mr. Caffey, Bob Caffey, who's sitting on the witness stand, now, were you friends? And Caffey replies, more or less. Warren Taylor says, well, Mr. Stevens has focused on the more. How about if we focus on less? And then he goes in to try and impugn his motives and his integrity. Colin Batty was convicted in an hour and a half. The jury didn't take long in this particular case. And in some way, I really think it had to do with the impression he made on these jurors, but obviously I can't prove any of that. He went to jail in 2 months, and then by the end of the summer of 1955, he left Alaska and moved back to California and eventually to Nevada, and was never heard of again in these parts. Johnny Warren remained under indictment. Ted Stevens said, he would always say something like, this is not a good time to proceed with the case. The investigation continues. Johnny Warren remained under indictment until 1960 and remained in Fairbanks. 1960, Jay Rabinowitz dropped the case, and there were any number of cases they also dropped, and there were probate matters that he cleaned up. This was a very important time. And you remember, of course, those of you who remember your constitutional history, this was a period of time when indictments could remain open for long periods of time, unlike now. Johnny Warren remained in Fairbanks and worked in Fairbanks for 3 or 4 or 5 years. Eventually, he moved away to Texas. It's very interesting when you talk to people about their evaluation of Johnny Warren, because Frank Wirth, who was the U.S. Marshal, was sent to California to get Johnny and bring him back here. I asked him, what did he make of Johnny Warren? He said, Johnny Warren, I like Johnny Warren. He didn't kill anybody. But we don't know. We don't know. We are left still with something of a mystery. Cecil Wells is buried here in Anchorage. And if you look at the last of the items I handed out to you, it says, Cecil M. Wells, 1902-1953, he loved Alaska foremost. Now, before we go home, I just wanted to go over these items real quickly in here for those who have them. This is the apartment building, as I explained to you, the Northward, where all the action went down. This is a picture of Cecil Wells in his capacity as chairman of the Chamber of Commerce. This is a full-page ad for Wells Alaska Motors. They're fabulous new Pontiacs. He would have been selling those and others. Marriage license for Diane and Cecil. Johnny Warren's military record. I don't know if any of you were at all involved in genealogy. This is from Ancestry.com. It's a paid service, costs like $150 a year. You can look up people, including members of your family. The police report, very brief one here. Newsminer coverage of the crime. These are photographs, they still exist, that the police took when they came to investigate the crime, the murder of Cecil Wells. They're in the state archives in Juneau. There are other ones that are more graphic of the crime scene, and I left those out. This is an ad for the opening of the grand opening of the Country Club, which is where Cecil and Diane met. This photograph here was reprinted hundreds of times all over the United States. This shows a jazz band playing at the Country Club in Fairbanks, and you'll see the arrows pointing to Johnny on the upper right and the lovely Diane on the lower left. One of the things that's really interesting and kind of, I don't know quite what to make of it, but I guess it's just a fact of life, is if you look at these people in these photographs, they frequently look very different to the point that you're wondering, is this the same person? This is Johnny, and on the left, on my left, and Frank Wirth. They're together as Frank is about to bring him back to Fairbanks under extradition. Next photo is not too good, but it is an early picture of Ted in Fairbanks at St. Matthew's Church. He was on the board there at one time. The man on the right is Bishop Gordon, who was very, very well known. Then we have some newspaper coverage. Time of shooting still not established. This is, I mentioned, these other cases that people thought they might be similar. Then we have Diane and Johnny are indicted for murder here. Wells case draws U.S. attention, and in here, Diane said that she'd been contacted from Europe. This photograph with Diane with the swollen eyes, this is not a great photograph. This is from Life magazine, which published a huge spread on this story. And I was going to find you the name of it here, but probably it just goes out of my head now, but it's very graphic. Here's the New York Daily News. I can't tell you how surprised I was to go into the New York Public Library and find this on microfilm. The Playgirl and the Drummer. It's a picture of Johnny. Once again, he's being extradited on the left and Diana on the right. Johnny's carrying his coat that way because he's wearing handcuffs. This is from one of the Police Gazette-type publications, Death and the Midas Touch. That's Diane on the left. And there's so many pictures of Diane, you can see that in many cases she doesn't really particularly look the same in any of them. This following is an example of stateside coverage. Diane denies killing or affair with drummer. The idea that the San Francisco Chronicle could call her just by her first name, presuming that the readers would have some idea. Now, as somebody being a former editorial page editor, maybe they just had space problems. This is a picture of Cecil and his one of his earlier wives, as well as Max and Betty Wells on the left. This is a story about the estate. The Oakland Tribune here is running a story. It's on the front page. Widow and Oakland pal jailed in Alaska murder. Next story is Johnny Warren hires lawyer, says he'll fight indictment. If you then the jazz musician you see earlier, you almost wonder if it's the same person. Here's something that's really, this is from the FBI file. You'll see that there's any number of things have been redacted. This is for the Beretta, which was unsuccessful. Here's a letter that Ted Stevens wrote. This is also from the FBI files to the to Warren Olney of the Attorney General's staff. And this is very interesting because Dr. Haglund, who was the doctor at that time, delivered many infants, set many broken bones. The doctor is now the opinion that the deceased met his death between 12 midnight and 4 a.m. on the morning of such and such. It's the doctor's further opinion that did not meet his death then, it occurred later. The purpose of this is to note, and it goes on to note here, that Johnny Warren had an alibi for an earlier time. Here I'm showing you, I just thought for the fun of it, this really doesn't advance the story very much. This is a letter signed by J. Edgar Hoover, allegedly. I don't know, so much of this course, I'm not sure if it actually was, if that was pro forma, or if that was an attempt to show that, you know, J. Edgar Hoover never sleeps. I like the salutation. My dear chief, sincerely yours, J. Edgar Hoover. This is Ted Stevens opposing a change of venue and other things in the trial. Ted goes on to say, there's a typo here. Ted, you missed it. The area in this court is located and remarkable for being devoid of racial prejudice. I don't think people in Fairbanks would have agreed with that. Plaintiff asserts that, he's filing with the court. Plaintiff asserts that defendant may secure a more fair trial and partial trial here in Fairbanks than in any other division in the territory, and even within the United States. This is pretty typical of the kind of headline you would see. Blonde accused with musician and slaying of millionaire husband takes fatal pills. This is from the Washington Post, which wasn't the great newspaper it is now. couple more stories about Diane and her death. This is from the Los Angeles Examiner, a big blowout after she committed suicide. Diane with Bill Columbaney, her note, her son, Mark. Story here about Columbaney being extradited from California to Alaska. This one I threw in just because, I couldn't resist. this is a story about Mildred Lenore Gilmore, who was Columbaney. His family had enough money that not only did they hire Warren Taylor, they hired her, and she came up here. You'll note here the heading is Woman Attorney for William Columbaney, left here last night. They identify her as Woman Attorney. This is former dancing school owner shocked by verdict of guilty. It's kind of got a little bit of the Roy Orbison look there with those glasses in that picture. Johnny Warren's trial is postponed, a date not set. There never was a trial. My dear friend Karen Erickson was able to obtain Johnny's death certificate. He died there's no question it's him. He died in Texas in 1997. Sounds like it says lung cancer, probably from smoking. We were able to find members of his family. They did not want to talk about this beyond said, yes, he was a musician. And that's what I have for you, and I've rambled on long enough, and many of you have to go back to work. Thank you very much. If you have to leave, please do. I know how busy everybody is. If you have one or two questions, I'll do my best to take them and do what I can. Yes, sir. No, and boy, would I have loved to have done that. I would have come in here and played them myself. Yes?
That article at this time of shooting is still not established. At the bottom it says there's a George Sullivan part of the...
Yep, that's him. I meant to mention that earlier. Thank you. That shows you the number of people who went back and forth between Anchorage and Fairbanks. A lot of the criminals did, but other people did as well. Yes?
Was she expecting child? It's cut up at the bottom of the...
Oh, there's a whole story, which is a complete sidebar, of suggestions that Diane had an abortion before she committed suicide. I don't know the truth of that. All I know was what was alleged.
The Bar Association folks have said that if you didn't get the materials, you can give your information to them and you can get them later.
Sir?
Has become Alaska sales.
Yeah, that's part of the story, too. I mean, this guy was very successful. Okay, everybody, have a great week. Great holiday. See you next year.
That was great. Thanks.
Thanks for coming.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, this was good. Well, blondes and murder, that's what...